All right, everybody, welcome. Thanks for joining us. We're going to get started here. I'll give you a quick heads up on what we're doing. We're going to do the first hour as the power hour. I've got Pete and Ethan here to help me out with questions, so start lining up all your questions for Pittsburgh Power. And then in the second hour, we'll be doing general questions, so you can start lining those up as well, and we'll get to those in the second hour. So either way, if you have any questions about anything at all, press 1 on your phone right now, and we'll do our best to get to you. I'll keep you updated as far as how we are on questions. Let's go ahead and get started.
In the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers. The list goes on and on. We'll take your calls and answer your questions about anything at all. Today is the Power Hour. We're going to get to your maintenance and engine-related questions today. Joining me to help out are Ethan and Pete from Pittsburgh Power this time. Hey, guys, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. How are you doing?
Hi, Kevin.
Doing great. Hey, great to see you guys down at the truck show. Are you recovered?
Barely. I'm still catching up. I mean, we were so busy at the show, and then come back Monday, and we were swamped. So the show did what it was supposed to do, bring us some business.
Yeah, you know, I've been going to that show. That was my 26th year, and it's cyclical. Some years it's just slammed. Other years it's slow. You know, the OEMs pulled out this year. We knew it was going to be down a little bit. I talked to a lot of vendors, and everybody agreed it was really slow. But every time I looked at your booth, and you guys have a big booth and a lot of people there, you guys were just covered up.
We had a good show. I think the crowds were down, but that wasn't a bad thing. Sometimes it gets so busy, people can't even get to you. And it doesn't do us any good. The crowds were down, but we were, like you said, we had six in the booth. We had a bigger booth this year, and there really wasn't a time that we had no one to talk to. It was just steady, which is makes the day go really fast without going crazy. So I thought it was one of our better shows, to be truthful.
You know, sometimes the busy shows, especially in our area, it's a little frustrating because sometimes I'll look up and people will be four and five deep waiting to talk to you. And it's just frustrating because you don't want to rush the person you are talking to, but you see how long people are waiting and you feel bad because you can't get to everybody. So sometimes, like you were saying, when the crowd's down, you know, we were busy in our area the whole time, but it was a nice balance.
It was. And like I said, I think it turned out to be a really good show for us.
Yeah, my travel could have been a little smoother. I almost didn't get there because of weather and flights. And then on the way back, my flight got canceled, and they couldn't get anything else till Tuesday. So I ended up renting a car and driving back to Omaha.
Wow. Yeah, the only problem we had, Austin and I drove back, and we like to stop just past Cincinnati someplace. We had to drive to Columbus to get a room. They had, of course, a truck show going on, you know, people leaving that. They had a dog show going on and some cheerleader competition. So we couldn't get a room until Columbus. That's halfway home at that point.
I was going to say, you almost feel like you're home by then.
Yeah, it's the halfway point for us.
So what's going on at the shop that's kind of interesting, or anything jump out at you from the show, like common questions or reoccurring themes or anything like that?
The shop was, for me, a little bit busy because I got to stay behind and hold down the fort there. Just the typical, you know, things, ECMs, wiring issues, just a little bit more chaotic because only one person here at the moment, and Leroy's due back tomorrow.
Yeah. I'll bet it was a little crazy for you.
Well, we got the engine back for the CMC build. We're getting that Detroit ready to build, and we got the block in today and the crank back from the machine shop. So we're going to start building that, getting everything prepped for the show.
Excellent. Speaking of which, I'm standing here looking at the Mac Center. We are going to be living here in the parking lot for the next 6 weeks just to make sure that we're ready for the show. Such a big transition this year, new location, you know, three lanes this year, lots of new speakers and topics. So we're here. So if you guys need to send anything here ahead of time, we can arrange for that, and we're here. So keep that in mind.
Great. Perfect.
All right. So anything you guys want to cover? Should we get to questions?
Yeah, I can't think of anything to cover. We might as well go to questions.
All right. Let's do that. Let's. We'll start off in Texas today. Patrick, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How y'all doing today?
Good. What's on your mind?
I'm in another one of those predicaments, something weird going on with my truck I can't quite figure out. I'm hoping that y'all can help me. If not, maybe a listener's ran into it before. It's a transmission issue that I know Pittsburgh Power doesn't deal a whole lot with, but I've got a 14-liter Detroit CDX5 04 Freightliner Classic short hood, and had that rear structure leak. Great jelly leak, rear crank seal, whatever you want to call it. To get to it, they had to pull the transmission and the rear motor mount loose. So while they had it apart fixing the leak, I had them put new rear motor mount. They said the clutch, you know, was in good shape but really wore and probably wouldn't last another 6 months to a year. So I had them go ahead and replace it. Further inspection, the input shaft was wore, so when it's all said and done, we got a new clutch, resurfaced the flywheel, new shifting forks, new pilot bearing, new input shaft, all that stuff. Got it all put in there, and we did install a lap clutch. They put the lap 2 in there, I believe. And
okay.
It pulls like a dream. No vibration. It runs a whole lot smoother. But after it gets warm, there's a chatter when I'm parked with the transmission in neutral and the clutch out. It's got like a weird random chatter to it, and then at complete random, there's no pattern to it. It will start to, sometimes it won't do it, sometimes it will. It'll start to make a grinding noise in the transmission. And I can pat the accelerator or press the clutch in, either one, and it immediately stops. But after you let it back out with the transmission in neutral, it starts the random chatter again, and then it might only do that random grinding noise once a day or once every couple days, or it might do it 2 or 3 times in a day. But like I said, the only thing that stops is either increasing the RPM, so I can put it in the high idle and it smooths out and won't do it at all.
Well, that's a lot of good information. I'm kind of clueless, Pete. This is probably a good question for you.
Okay. Well, one, it sounds like they didn't cut any corners, which is a good thing, because that's typically all the parts we replace when we do a clutch. So it sounds like they did a good job as far as that goes. But we've run into a couple cases when they changed the main shaft. The gear that it mates to is worn. And I'm wondering if it's worn there and they didn't catch it, would be my first thought. Now, unfortunately, the transmission would have to get pulled, and they would have to pull the main shaft back off to inspect that.
Okay.
That would be something, because you have a fresh teeth on the main shaft up against teeth that are worn. And like I said, we've probably had, I don't know, we don't do a whole lot of transmissions, but I know the last couple, the gears in the transmission were bad there, and it had to be gone through. Maybe they missed that. Someone might not have been paying attention or didn't look at it right. But that's my thought that might be going on.
I was kind of researching, and I found some people saying that there was some rattle in the slack, you know, of older transmissions from torsional vibration. And the guy at my Freightliner dealership that I don't use for my mechanic work, but he's a really sharp guy, he told me that he thought that the springs in that light clutch might have been stiffer than the ones that were in the old, because it wasn't doing it before. But what you're saying makes sense, but he told me he thought it was torsional vibration chattering the slack in those gears after they put the new input shaft in. And so I replaced the crankshaft damper on the front of the motor, and it quieted it down some where it's not near as bad, but it didn't fix the problem. But what you're saying, I think, makes a lot of sense. I don't know really, I guess, other than tearing the transmission completely back out, just there's much else. I pulled the VTO blade off and checked the drain plug and the fill plug, and there was very little metal shavings at all. I pushed the clutch in, rolled all the gears over. And, you know, there were some of them that were a little sharper than others, but not, you know, there was no chunks or any noticeable other normal wear. So I guess my only option is to pull it out.
All right, well, there's the music. We're going to have to get to a break. Hold on. We will come right back after this. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. It is the Power Hour. I've got Pete and Ethan here helping me out with questions. Pete, you know, that certainly sounds like a good explanation. Is this something that if you could kind of put up with it, I know it's really annoying, but if you could put up with it, is this something you could let go for a while, or is there any danger in doing that and you need to get on it right away?
I wouldn't let it go too long because you're going to accelerate the wear of the new teeth on the main shaft. Again, I don't think
he
has to shut down today to do it, but I would do it within a few weeks.
Got it. All right. Let's head off to, well, we'll stay right there in Texas. Dale, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Yep, it's your turn. What's on your mind today?
Hey, I got a 07 Pete 386, and it's got a C15 cat. It's got 1,950,000 miles on it. It's never been opened. The only thing been done is three injectors replaced over the time. And I talked to a mechanic the other day, and he said it would be a good idea to drop the pan and check bearings. But it's not using much oil. It's only using about a gallon of oil every 11,000 miles or so. And I do oil samples every 15,000, and they're coming back good. So I was just thinking, couldn't that cause a problem by messing with something that ain't? I was just wanting to get y'all's opinion.
Did you say 1.9 million miles?
Yes, sir.
I was wondering that myself.
Sure,
that's incredible.
Yeah, you're
What's
sure
that?
It hasn't been touched?
I've owned it ever since it had 400,000.
Wow.
And
well,
the only thing,
an A-cert go that long. I was just going to say, I've never seen an A-cert go that long. That's amazing.
Well, I'll tell you, I've had really good luck with them. I had an 04 Kenworth, and it had C15 in it, and it went 1.4 million. And I sold it to my nephew, and he drove it out till it had 1.6 million. before he had an end frame done on it.
That's great stuff. I'll jump in, and then Pete, you guys can jump in. You know, at 1.9 million, even if you're not using oil, and if there was bearing wear, you'd probably notice drop in oil pressure. We'd be seeing lead and copper in there. It doesn't hurt to pull off the pan and look at bearings. There's no danger in looking, but I don't think anything sounds like it needs it. But you've got to realize that at that age, you're at risk of metal fatigue causing some sort of catastrophic failure that you'll just never see coming. So your oil consumption may not be there. The bearings are probably good. Sounds like they are. But I would certainly have enough money in the bank to do the in-frame, or I may even just do it anyway. Pete, what do you think?
No, I agree with you. He's definitely on borrowed time, and obviously he's doing a fantastic job maintaining it to get that kind of mileage out of it. The oil pressure is good. Oil analysis is good. I probably wouldn't check the bearings myself. But, again, keep in mind, like Kevin said, you're on borrowed time.
All righty. Well, I appreciate y'all's input. I want to thank you. Y'all have a great day.
You too.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. It's amazing. I somebody's doing something right there.
Yep, absolutely. We had a C15 that had 1.3 million, and the bearings looked brand new, and he never touched them.
Yeah, you know, bearings today, you guys probably see a lot of this. Bearings usually aren't the reason we're doing in-frames. Usually cylinder kits or something else goes first, and a lot of times you pull bearings out and they still look great.
Yep, a blown head gasket, you know, that kind of mileage, you have to rebuild it then. Low line of protrusion.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's usually the failure nowadays.
Yeah. Now, on the other hand, I was standing there in your booth at the show, and somebody walked up with a set of bearings out of a Series 60, and I guess they had about 1.6 million miles on them. They looked so bad, and it turned out it was about 100,000.
Yes. Yep, correct. Yeah, it was a real low-mileage engine. I don't know. Bruce had showed me the bearings, but I don't know the history behind it, what the deal was with it. But they were in pretty rough shape.
They were. They were horrible. And there was nothing. I looked at some of the history. I didn't have a lot of time either. I looked at some oil samples, and there was nothing in the oil sample that would have caused it. Now, we saw the lead and the copper, and it happened really fast, but there was nothing in that oil sample that, you know, there was no fuel dilution. Viscosity was perfect. There was no buildup of soot. There wasn't a lot of silicon. There was no oxidation. They were good oil samples. So it wasn't caused by an oil problem.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't see that. But, was it a glider or was it a reman engine? Do you know?
It was a glider. Yeah, and it was a remanned engine. It was a factory reman, and it had like 110,000 miles on it. And all they did was put another set of bearings in it, which I have a feeling he's going to wipe them out again.
Yeah, especially with the oil analysis showing no other signs causing it.
Yeah,
a crank
something
issue
else
or
really
a line board
that,
issue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I told him
all of them.
Yeah, I told him to stay in touch and try to get his oil analysis right over to us so we could keep an eye on it quick. But 110,000, that's crazy.
Yeah. Sure is.
Let's speaking of gliders, let's head off to Arizona. Kurt, welcome to the program.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
I got a question toward the gliders. Would it be cheaper to have my own engine and transmission versus purchasing it through with the glider or what?
I'll jump in and then, Pete, you guys build them. So, you know, a lot of it depends on the glider builder, the manufacturer. A lot of them don't want to mess around pulling engines and parts out of other trucks, so they'll kill you with labor. So it just depends. like the high volume manufacturers, they get engines, all that stuff in. They want to build them, throw them in the truck and move on. Some of the lower volume or custom builders, yeah, I'm sure you're going to save a lot of money having your own components. Guys, what do you think?
Yeah, if his engine's in good shape and the transmission's in good shape, I mean, that's what the gliders were originally for, you know, using your parts. And that would definitely save you a bunch of money. Now, if they have to get rebuilt, of course, that's going to add to the price. But if you can yank them out and put them in the new truck, that'd save you a bunch of money. I would have no problems doing that.
Well, I was looking at having it rebuilt before we even put it in. Do the outer frame complete.
Okay, well, then you save the price of a core, so that'll save you some money. If you
What's
have your own core, that's – well, for the engine. Like if you're
yeah,
buying
– how much is ballpark?
How much is a core?
Yes.
An N14.
N14, I'd say $5,000 or $6,000 anyhow. I haven't priced N14 core, but that's $5,000 or $6,000 in your pocket.
I bought the whole truck, so I think I've done okay for $6,500 and
Absolutely.
Drove it home. It was
mm-hmm.
running until November. The guy had a stroke, and a friend of mine, and he asked me what I'd give him for him, and I asked him what he wanted for it. I tried to get it for too little, I think.
What transmission is in there?
A Super 10. I don't think I want to go with that.
No. But you still did pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, something else I'm exploring right now. What year and what truck?
It's a 97 T600 Super 10 with the 8-bag air ride suspension, 370s, I think it is.
Got it. One of the things I'm starting to explore and talking to some people about, mostly because of the whole issue of gliders possibly going away, in the next year or two, and we're still looking at that. But the idea of just yanking the cab off that thing, once the cab's off, reconditioning everything that's left is pretty simple, and then buying a new cab, put a whole new cab on it. And, you know, I don't have
the cab and sleeper's in good shape.
Then, you know, you might be able to just... You might just be able to refresh everything and get away at about a third of the cost of a glider and still have a really nice truck, especially with a PACCAR product. You know, they're quality. The cabs in that hold up really well.
Because he was driving it until the day – it's the hood that's the rough part, and that's about it.
Well, that's easy to fix.
$1,800
so
already checked.
Yeah, you know, when you think about the glider, even with your components, if you're going to do an auto frame, and you want to do another PACCAR glider, you're probably still in the 130 range. If you think about how much money you could spend reconditioning an older truck, customizing it, something to think about. The music's playing. I've got to get to a break. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. This is the Power Hour. We're going to get back to some phone calls. We're going to head off to Minnesota. Matt, go ahead.
Hi. I had some questions about my fast fuel system. The last truck we built, I've been having problems. It runs once you get up to cruising speed, it's fine. When you idle it, the fuel is, I mean, the smoke burns your eyes and going through the gears, it's just a dog. But then you get on the freeway speeds and you're fine. We've changed the custom computer that I had to get to make the old motor talk to the new truck. We changed the ECM out and we unplugged the fast. And then for a couple of days it worked great and I thought it was the fast system. But I got a call this morning. It's acting up again, and I'm running out of ideas.
Have you done any oil samples?
Yes, and oil samples came back good.
What lab did them?
Growmark.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that one. And the reason I ask that, because I was looking for fuel dilution. I'll let Pete and those guys jump in here. The problem with a lot of labs today is that they can't detect fuel dilution because of the new fuel blends, the biodiesels, the low sulfur.
Okay.
And a lot of times they'll show no fuel dilution, and we'll run one through our lab and we'll see high fuel dilution. The other place you can look is at viscosity. Even if they don't pick up on the fuel dilution, if viscosity is lower than what we think it should be, about the only thing that really lowers viscosity is fuel dilution. So that's another place to check. If you had the numbers in front of you, I could probably tell you. Pete, what do you think?
What engine was this again?
N14 Select Plus.
Okay, that's not normally an issue, smoke with those. Is it fairly smooth or does it seem rough?
No, we got your balancer on there. And you could put a coffee cup on the dash and the driver just came out of a new truck and it is smoother than that. That's what's throwing me. We used all new OEM Cummins injectors. That was the first thing I was going to go for. And then I even had it at Kenworth a couple times because I just got fed up with trying to figure it out, and I needed it on the road. It runs, and when it goes down the freeway, it's smooth as can be. But when you sit there and idle, I mean, the smoke is so rich, it burns your eyes. So that's telling me there's unburned fuel.
Mm-hmm. N14s are somewhat known for injector issues, even with Cummins Reman. That's a known problem. Now, typically, the complaint is it running rough, a misfire. What you're describing is not norm, but that doesn't mean that an injector is not causing that.
So, because they can be intermittent, maybe when it's going through the gears, off the throttle, on the throttle, maybe I do have an injector that's messing up.
That would be my guess. Now, the way to find it, you would have to have it in the shop while it was acting up. And two things, they can short out injectors to see if anything clears it up. Or what I like to do is yank the manifold off and run it and see which cylinder is causing the smoke. I doubt it would be all of them. And you can isolate, you know, one or two cylinders that's causing the problem.
I can plug into it.
Yeah, I was going to say, Pete, I heard him say that he had the custom programming done to get it to talk to the newer chassis. Any chances of programming, just putting too much fuel into the cylinder at idle?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah, okay. It's possible, but it's the N14s, they're limited what you can do there, but anything's possible there.
Okay.
The other thing we did change out, because I would building another glider, I did have that other custom, I did have a spare custom computer. We switched that out and that didn't make any difference. That's what I was thinking, but I don't know of anything else that can tell it to take more fuel than that and the ECM. I mean, it's a simple motor. This should be a simple solution, but I've been messing around with it for 3 weeks and running out of ideas, I guess.
Yeah, as far as the programming, is it so that it'll interface with the newer truck?
Yes, it's in a M14 and a T660 2016 chassis.
Yeah, the electronics are pretty basic in the N14.
And pretty complicated in the truck.
Yeah.
Okay. And getting it to work together would be interesting, but I don't see how that would affect the fueling at all. Now,
only difference I have from this truck and from the four other ones I've built is it's got has the fast fuel system. So we shut that off, unplugged it, I should say, and it ran great for 2 days. We thought we had it figured out. Well, I guess we didn't. We did not have it figured out, and it started acting up again. So the only thing we could think of is because of the extra fuel pressure from the fast was feeding too much fuel, and something wasn't talking, or I don't know.
Well,
and we unplugged
pressure,
it, and that did not work.
The fast system will make 16 pounds, whatever, pressure to the supply pump, but the supply pump itself specs 130 to 150. And we've fooled with it and raised them, and it virtually had no effect on it. So I don't think the supply pump or the fast pump would have any effect on that issue.
Got it.
And
Pete, it sounds like this is one
injectors.
Of you. You've just got to get into the shop and get your hands on it.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, let's head off. We're going to go to John. Welcome to the program. It's your turn. John, are you? Oh, looks like John just dropped off. So let's go to Manitoba. Nathan, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going, Kevin?
Good. What's on your mind?
I was told to tell you a quick story first. It turns out a long time ago, my dad is helping me get started as an owner-operator to start out. I pull a set of hoppers around, and I was talking to him about different things, fuel performance and all these other things. He says, where are you learning all this stuff? And I said, well, this guy on the radio that I listen to in the XM and read his stuff online, Kevin Rutherford, he's got all this stuff that he talks about. He goes, oh, I know Kevin. And I said, oh, you know him? Like, you've heard of him? He goes, no. Years and years ago, when Kevin was first getting started in trucking, I met him at the Mid-America Truck Show. And we got to talking about trucks. He said, the guy's really, really good with money, and I knew he was going to do great things. He never listens to XM Radio, doesn't even own an XM Radio. So he's never heard of you until I told him that. And he goes, oh, I know him. I showed him your picture on your site. And he goes, oh, I remember him when he had hair, though.
Yeah. Well, that really was a long time ago. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
I love that story.
So the big thing we're looking at now is looking at building the gliders, since a lot of these trucks that are out here pulling hoppers with us, we're grossing between 105 and 109,000. We're loaded about 90% of the time. And most of the newer trucks, they've always have issues of sensors going out, particulate filters, all these things that you talk about are even more accelerated with us because we're hauling heavy and all these other things. So we looked at doing a glider, and I was looking to get a little bit of your input on it. Aerodynamics are kind of almost out. We're pulling a set of doubles that are hoppers. So it's there, but, you know, I don't know to what extent that plays in.
Yeah, I'll jump in. You know, if I were building a glider in this situation, two trucks come to mind, and I'm not even sure about availability on either one of them. I think they're both available, but you'd have to double check. And I wouldn't discount aerodynamics. No matter what you're pulling behind you, every aerodynamic problem compounds itself. So if we can solve one aerodynamic problem, even if we have six more, we're still going to see a gain. So for me, I would be looking at a T800. I just really like those for heavy haul. Or I'd be very interested in the new Western Star. I think it's the 5700. It's the first aerodynamic truck they've built, but it's again, more of a heavy haul truck. And I'm sure you guys would agree with this. A 6NZ would be the engine I'd put in it for that operation.
We just built a...
Hold that thought. We'll get to the break, and we'll come right back and let you guys weigh in on that. So stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment. It is the Power Hour. We're going to get right back to the phone calls. Before the break, we were talking with Nathan in Manitoba, and you guys were about to jump in there. Go ahead.
Yeah, we actually built a Cat 6NZ for a Western Star glider. We didn't build the glider here. We just built the engine. But they brought it back after they were done, and we put it on the dyno. And it turned out we actually had to turn it down a little bit because we had too much power.
Well, that's a good direction to have to go. And I just think for heavy haul, that would be a great combination, a Western Star and a 6NZ.
Oh, yeah. And the trucks look good, and then they pull well.
Yeah.
As far as if you guys were thinking like rear ends and transmission, right now we've got 355s. I got a 6NZ in this Freightliner with 355s and a 13-speed, 22 low rupper. And so pretty much the same setup as what I've got, except throwing it in a Western Star, maybe having you guys build the motor.
You know, the gears are okay. You could even go with 370s, you know, depending on speed and some other things. You know, in that operation, I might lean towards the 18-speed. I don't, you know, spec them a lot, but if you're heavy all the time, it wouldn't be a bad idea.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. That gives us a pretty good start. It's a lot of the stuff that I've been kind of leaning towards anyways with your direction, so.
Excellent. Sounds great. Let's squeeze in some more calls before we've got to wrap this up. Let's go to Alabama. Stuart, welcome to the program. Are you there? Sounds like somebody's there going once. Stuart in Alabama. All right. Let's go to New York instead. Pete, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kev. You know, I got an N14. I got 1,141,000 miles on it. I got four original injectors. But I get that little puffing every so often that one guy was talking about. And what seems to help, I know you don't believe in additives and stuff, but what I've been doing for quite a while now, actually since they took the sulfur out of the fuel, is putting that two-cycle oil that AMSOIL makes. And I'll tell you what, that smooths out the engine. I've been trying to find the little mist that I get every so often when I accelerate. Every time I take it to Cummings, you know, they look at me, they says, you know, we've never seen an N14 run as smooth as yours does. You know, we're going to be wasting your money, you know, if it doesn't do it while we have it on the dyno and so forth. And so far, that seems to work for me. And I got a feeling that acting up on me is one of the ones that I replaced, not the original ones. You know, so I sort of hesitate to replace any of the injectors because to me it seems like the ones that you get from the factory seem to be the problem.
Pete, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with him on that. There's a good chance that if he would replace them, they're not going to be any better or worse than what he has. And if that's the only complaint, I think I'd just tough it out and keep running it.
You know, here's another thing that's kind of weird. I got the fast system, but I don't have I got the old man's system. Anyways, I have it on a switch, and I got a generator. So at night when I run my generator, I leave that preparator on running, all night long. And by filtering the fuel, that truck idles even smoother in the morning just from, you know, because it does 150 gallons an hour. You figure, you know, you're in bed for 8-9 hours, and that thing's running all that time. And it seems like every time I fill up, then it'll start running rough till it gets filtered. Then it goes back to running pretty smooth. You know, so I got a feeling it's a lot of the sulfur that got taken out and you don't have the lubrication. That's the problem.
Well, you know, as far as additives go, I just want to be clear. Additives for me are kind of like supplements for our body. If we can identify a problem and there's an additive or a supplement that will fix the problem, then I'm okay with it. In fact, I would recommend it sometimes. But what I fight against are these additives that make all these wild claims about making oil super slick and making fuel, 10% fuel efficiency gains and all these other wild claims on high priced additives that they want you to put in all the time. I just don't think that ever works. Not a good idea. I've tested a lot of them. But if you have an additive that you're putting in and it maybe keeping injectors clean and things are running better, then absolutely do it.
Well, I figured, what do you call it? There is a deficiency in the fuel for lubrication.
Yeah.
So I figured,
yeah, there's no doubt.
Yeah. And to me, I'm an old timer, so for the longest time I was a transmission fluid guy, and then, when I started thinking, transmission fluid was never meant to be burnt, but two-cycle oil always was meant to be burnt.
I kind of feel the same way. If you're going to dump something in, and I used to do transmission fluid for years, but there are a lot of additives in there that don't burn, whereas two-cycle oil was designed to go through the fuel system. So either, an additive that's designed for that, something Lucas fuel conditioner, things like that. Pete, what do you think? What's it sound like to you on this one?
Well, yeah, I agree with the oil additives. I don't see a need for it. But the fuel additives, on our Dodges, they're all diesels. We put the Lucas in every fuel up. Definitely can hurt. We know there's a lack of lubricity in the new fuels. And I do get a lot of guys tell me after running it that the trucks run better. And with the N14 injectors being kind of the way they are, I think it's a good idea to run something in there.
Yeah. It, like you say, in this case, it can't hurt. And if you notice an improvement, then I'd certainly keep doing it.
Yeah. Another thing that I've found that's kind of weird is the inside of the tanks have, how a tank looks from the outside when you use the chemicals on it to clean it, what it got, that real nice shiny aluminum. That's the way the inside of my tanks are. And at one time I had that black crap in there, and I was trying to scrape it with a putty knife, and then I went to one of those marine places like you suggested, and Cummings has got some stuff, and between that and then the two-cycle oil and stuff, now those doggone tanks shine inside. It's just unreal.
Well, that's certainly a good sign. And I think I'm with Pete on this one. It doesn't seem like a major injector problem, I might just put up with it for a while because things could certainly get worse. Let's go to Pennsylvania. Lavko, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I had a C15 rebuilt, and I did what was advised that after 10,000 miles, I changed the oil. And I got an oil sample back from the place that you deal with that I've been dealing with them regularly. And my question is that one side it says wear metals and the next column it says contaminants. What kind of level on a newly rebuilt within 10,000 miles should I have, level of contaminants or level of wear metals should be showing on that chart?
I really recommend a 5,000-mile oil change after an in-frame, and I think, Pete, you guys do too. If you go to 10, I almost ignore that first oil sample. At 10,000 miles, unless you had something that jumped up to a level 4, I don't think I would get too worried about a 2 or a 3. I think I would change the oil, do another 15,000-mile sample and see what that looked like. Pete, don't you guys usually recommend a 5,000-mile change after an in-frame?
We actually do it in a 1,000 or 2,000 miles. We dump the oil. We know there's a lot of contaminants in there. Yeah, and not even that, but just things like anti-seize we use on the head bolts. Sometimes it gets on the cylinder or the bolt itself, which gets washed off by the oil. Now we have high copper in the oil, which really isn't there. It's just because of the anti-seize we use on the head bolt. or the compound that Detroit uses. So you get a lot of false readings. So I tell my guys not to even sample the oil till like the third change, because they're going to see stuff they don't like. It's not really there.
Okay, well, my situation is that I don't believe this engine was rebuilt, because it shows almost perfect. And apparently this thing was rebuilt, and it shows perfect. Shows like a nice, tight engine and everything. It sounds like an engine that's been broken in for, a few thousand miles there. And so this is why I was asking for some kind of numbers, parts per million, that I should...
Yeah. Well, that was new information. Slavko, if you could, call back on another show and get me a copy of the oil sample, and we'll take a look at it now that I know that's what you're thinking. Pete, Nathan, we're all out of time. Thanks, guys, for joining us and helping out with all those questions. And we'll see you next time. This has been the Power Hour. Thanks for joining me. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, give me 1 minute, and you're going to hear 1 minute of silence. We'll come back and start the second hour. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers. The list goes on and on. If you've got a question about anything at all, pick up the phone, give me a call, and we'll talk about it here on the air. And I think we're just going to get right to the phone calls tonight and see what it is you want to talk about. I've got some things, but I think I'll hold off and get to some of your calls first. Let's go to Minnesota. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. My boss wants to start a retirement program for me, and he's thinking an IRA, but I've read Tony Robinson's book, and I'm thinking the America's Best 401k. I'm wondering what your opinion is.
I'm certainly with you on the 401k is a better program. Whether or not it's a better program in this case, we'll have to work through. So sounds to me like we're talking about a pretty small company. How many employees?
Two.
That's small. Do you know if the owner has any kind of retirement account for himself?
I believe so.
Do you know what it is?
Not off the top of my head, no. I'd have to ask.
Okay. Yeah, for really small companies like this, it can be difficult. But America's Best 401k, that's exactly what they were designed for. They were designed for very small companies that don't want the expense of an administrator, which a 401k plan requires, and that's the whole point. So he may want to look at, what are the possibilities of maybe moving what he has already. The other thing that would come into question, the real advantage to a 401k over an IRA, the tax treatment is virtually identical. They're almost, and There's two big issues when we're talking about retirement accounts. It's a shame that we've made this so complicated because it doesn't need to be, but that's our government. There's two big issues we always look at. How will the money be taxed? How and when will it be taxed? Because all money gets taxed. It's just a matter of, you know, depending on what kind of retirement account you have, how and when it gets taxed. And then the second big consideration is how much money can we get in? If we look at an IRA, a traditional IRA, or a traditional 401k, they're taxed the same. They're virtually identical. In fact, there isn't a single difference anywhere. The difference is how much you can contribute. So if he's not planning on contributing more than $5,000 a year to your account, then the IRA will do just fine, and it's easy and it's simple. If he wants to do more than $5,000 a year, which would be wonderful, then you're probably going to need, and depending on your age and some other things, probably more like $5,500 or even $6,500 in an IRA. But in a 401k, we can get up to $40,000 in contributions, depending on salary and a bunch of other things. So that's really the issue here. But the 401k, even at America's Best 401k, is going to get a little more complicated. It's going to put some more requirements on him as far as, you know, if there are more employees, is he going to have to contribute for them as well? Does he have to contribute for himself? It just, unfortunately, our government has made this very complicated. So my guess is, and I could be wrong, but at $5,500, he's probably not going to exceed that contribution a year, is he?
No, it's only like $100 a week. So $5,200.
Yeah, so, yes, well, wait a minute. $100 a week. I mean, we're approaching $5,000 a month, or $5,000 a year, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Close. That's very generous of him, by the way. That's a fantastic contribution. So you should certainly be thankful for that. But we're still under the limits. I mean, we're talking about $5,200, and you'd still be okay with an IRA, and it is easier.
Okay. That was kind of my question on what was going to be easier. I thought the America's Best 401k was going to be better for me in the long run, but I'll have them start the IRA. So it's
a family deal.
So
yeah, and again, I wish there were easier answers to these kind of questions, but I understand where you're coming from. You listen to the book; they certainly make a great argument for a 401k. I'd love 401ks. Because they give us all that freedom to make bigger and bigger contributions each year as we can. But in this case, when somebody's doing it for you, and it really is a great benefit, I would be inclined to make it as easy on them as possible. You could, here's the thing. Why don't you do this? And again, just because the answers aren't always that simple and we don't have enough time to explore it on the air, why don't you contact America's 401k directly? When you've got some time, you've read the book, all the numbers are in there, contact them, give them the situation as far as ownership of the company, employees, what you're looking to do. And if they can pull it off pretty easy, then it really wouldn't matter to him. And it would give you more flexibility in case you wanted to contribute as well.
Okay. Yeah, it's a fair tax now situation that we really need. So thank you very much for your time. I'll try. If I got any other questions, I'll give you a call. Thank you very much, Devin.
Sounds great. Great book, by the way. Thanks for bringing that up. I'm glad you listened to it. Tremendous amount of information in that book. If you haven't heard me talk about it, it's I'll give you the title and the author. It's called Money, Master the Game by Anthony Robbins. Excellent book. The best financial book I've ever read by far. In fact, I say that I went through the most intense financial training available in the U.S. to become a certified financial planner. Took me about 3 years. The exam to get your license is probably the most difficult thing I've ever done. I passed, luckily. And honestly, for the real world, you and I investing money, saving money, managing money, I would recommend that book over the three-year program and all the other stuff I went to. It's got more good, useful information in it. I wish we could get it taught in high schools. Let's see. I should probably look at the clock and see what we're doing here. I think I can get started on a call. And if we have to, we'll carry it into the next segment. Let's go to Pennsylvania. Russ, welcome to the program.
Oh, Kevin, missed you at the mass. The reason I'm calling is you had a rerun on Sunday night. A gentleman from Washington's got a TWS that's pushing oil out the breathers.
Yes, I remember the call.
Did he look at his compressor, air compressor?
You know, I do remember the call. I don't remember if we addressed that, but I know I had another one here recently where we did talk about that. So that is certainly a great recommendation.
You know, he said he had went back into it and checked the rings and everything and all that, but I've had a couple of them where the air compressor is starting to let go and it's dumping pressure into the crankcase. A friend of mine had a Detroit. It would literally blow the valve cover gasket completely out of it.
Wow. That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, yeah. So, but...
No, that's
all, go ahead.
Well, that's a great recommendation. Thank you for that. And I'm trying to remember because we had this issue a couple times here recently. I don't think we did approach that with the guy in the 2WS, though. So a great recommendation. I'm looking at the clock. We are coming up on the break. So I'm going to take us into the break. And then when we get back, we'll get to more of your calls and questions. If you haven't been to the website, check it out. We're always updating and adding new stuff. If you are thinking about coming to the CMC, we still have room. We'd love to have you there. The lineup just keeps getting better and better. We have so much going on. I probably need to put a webinar together where I take just about an hour and explain everything going on this year. There's so much. So, still time to get signed up. You can go to the website, letstruck.com, look under the events tab, or you can give us a call, 855-800-FUEL, 855-800-3835. And you don't have to get the whole thing paid off before the event. We have a payment plan, and it's only going to cost you $100 or $200 before the event. Then you'll have a year to pay it all off with all that new knowledge you have. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I also want to remind you about the payment plan. We really want people to take advantage of this. We want you to get this information. So many times people say, well, I just can't save up the $1,500 I need. But it's not going to cost you $1,500 all at once. We're going to finance this for you at a very low charge, and they pay it off the less finance charge you pay, so it's totally in your control. But a lot of people think that when we get this close to the event that the payment plan goes away. It doesn't. We don't treat it any different. It costs just right around $100 or so to lock in your reservation, and then we charge you about $100 a month or so till you get it paid off. And that works right up till the event. We don't make you pay it off before you come. And the beauty of that is that I can guarantee you, if you come to the event and you sign up right now on the payment plan, it's almost like the event becomes free. You're going to pay a little bit of money now. You're going to come and learn hundreds of ways to be more profitable. And then after you leave here, that $100 a month is going to feel like pennies. It's going to be so easy to pay it off with all the new information you have. So I'm excited this year because we have virtually unlimited space. For the last many, many years, we've been sold out. We've had to turn people away. This year, I'm excited. We can sign people up. Like I say, it's a little tough if we get a huge rush, but we'll figure it out. We'll add staff if we have to. So give us a call, go to the website, whatever it takes. We'd love to see you here in Council Bluffs. Let's go to Virginia. Steve, welcome to the program. Steve, are you with me? Wait a minute. Looks like it might be on my end here. Steve, are you there?
I'm here. Are you there?
There you go. There you go. I'm here now, so go ahead.
I didn't hear the click that time either. I didn't hear it the first two times. Okay. Yeah, I've got some blood work done, and I haven't got it in front of me, but she gave me the pertinent numbers. I've got to go by and physically pick it up. She wouldn't email it to me. But I went to a nurse practitioner and at a clinic, and she wanted to do blood work. And I said, well, what kind of blood work do you want to do? She said, cholesterol. I said, well, do you know of a thing called a lipoprotein panel? And she said, oh, yeah. She said, hey, I said, will you do that? And she said, yeah, I'll do that. So she was a little more knowledgeable than some. She looked like she was very young and probably just recently got her certification. So she's kind of like a PA, like a physician's assistant, which I would rather talk with them than doctors because they don't fall down at you. They don't look like they're itching to get out the door, you know. So
I agree.
So we did go through it. She actually called me yesterday. And like I said, she wouldn't email it to me, but she gave me the pertinent numbers. And I knew family history. I'm always a bit high on the total cholesterol, 242. And I was a little lower than I like on HDL at 49. I like it to be about 60. But probably hadn't done as much power walking during the winter, and that's probably where I got that. She was concerned about the triglycerides at 160. And I said, yeah, I wanted to get that down. I'm thinking you were talking about 120, 110. Is that a better? Is that about the level we need to get the triglycerides down to?
Before I get to that, do you have your LDL number?
Yes, I've got the LDL number. The LDL number is 182, of which 35 is the VLDL and 147 is the big fluffy stuff.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. And with all four numbers, I can kind of run some calculations on, ratios and some of that other stuff. I don't put hard numbers on any of these categories. And the reason that I don't is because hard numbers in any one category is almost always meaningless, because what we're typically looking for are ratios instead of looking at one category. And you just gave me the information on the LDL. The number itself is kind of meaningless, because if it's leaning very heavily towards the large fluffy kind, then at worst it's neutral, meaning it just doesn't affect your health at all. Or it some people believe it's still protective, almost like HDL is. So that's a good ratio of, LDL, meaning the small dense stuff. You don't have hardly any of that. So the triglycerides compared to the HDL, a little high. I mean, that's probably where you need to see the biggest improvement, but nothing that I would even consider taking any kind of a drug for. So hopefully nobody's even talking about statins, although a doctor would, just because of the high total number. And it's not outrageously high. 240 is nothing. But I think the new standards, the doctors are required to prescribe a statin on anything over 200, which is insanity. And I saw something the other day. There is actually a push to make statins over-the-counter medication.
Oh, my. when we were talking the other day, I could tell she is not, she's not naturopathic. However, she was saying some things that led me to believe that, she said, well, diet and nutrition, well, she's learned a little bit more just coming out of school, I think, than some of the earlier PAs or doctors had, because she definitely was open. I mean, she jumped right on doing the Life Protein panel. And also, when she said yesterday, she said, well, I have to tell you, here's what is the recommended thing is to do a stat. She said, but I'd rather be conservative and see if you can get some of your numbers in line in 6 months. And I'd rather be conservative. I told her statins were kind of a no-go because of side effects. But I didn't go further than that to tell her that. I mean, I did tell her I've done a lot of research on them. And I said research with the Cleveland Clinic because I've read his book there, Dr. Hyman, I think it is.
Great book.
So, yeah, great book. And this is like the director of the Cleveland Clinic. I mean, he gets it. You know, there's very few in his line of in his pay grade with medical companies that are getting it, and he gets it. But she was at least, open about that. And also, when I explained to her that I don't feel like the 242 is that bad, I said, I'd like to get the HDL higher. I said, which would actually possibly make my total cholesterol a little higher. I said, but if I could get the HDL up a little bit, the triglycerides down a little bit, I like the ratio I already have on the LDL.
Yeah.
I would be totally happy. What do you think is the best way to get the triglycerides down? I know if I power, it's getting warmer. If I power walk every day, my HDL will go up into the 60s. I'm 61 years old, but I do a lot of power walking.
I
do a lot of power walking, and when I do that, I stay very healthy.
Yeah, which is outstanding, by the way. So absolutely do that. With every book I've read, well over 100 now, lots of them were on cholesterol and diet. The single most effective way to raise HDL and lower triglycerides is a strict ketogenic diet. The lower you go in carbohydrates, the more those two numbers improve. Now, when you remove carbohydrates out of the diet, you have to replace them with something. And everybody today that gets this, including Dr. Hyman, is leading towards fats. Moderate protein. Protein seems to be one of those things that we've just overblown. We don't need nearly as much of it as what they've told us. It's easy to overdo protein because it's available. It's everywhere. It's satisfying. We'd like to eat it. So you do have to be a little careful with the protein. We're still a little gun shy on fats, but not even just fat. I mean, now in Dr. Hyman's new book, he's put some people on 80% fat with about 50 or more percent of that being saturated fat. Just make sure it's good, high quality saturated fat, good organic coconut oils and coconut products. Avocados, which are not really a lot of saturated, good grass-fed butter, high-quality beef and pork, grass-fed and pastured, using lard and tallow for cooking. Bulletproof coffee is a great way. So let me get to a break. We'll come back and we'll see kind of where you are on some of those macronutrients, and we'll go from there. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to go back to Virginia. I was talking with Steve. Steve, so about how many grams of carbohydrates, net carbs, are you taking in a day right now, do you think?
I try to keep those down a lot. I probably get most of my stray ones. I do put butter, Kerrygold in my coffee in the morning, but I still kind of put a little bit of French vanilla. I need to go with the sugar-free when I do it because I'm sure I'm getting most of my carbs in that. And whatever you're getting out of your salad dressing, things like that. I do use the full fat one, but, you know, I know you're getting some other things and that is probably not good. Probably being in the truck with the refrigeration I have at this point, I'm probably not keeping my fats as clean as I could be. I am gonna be changing the refrigeration in here a little bit. I wanna start fermenting some vegetables at home and having those with me too. And the more things that'll attack the gut and give me the things that I really need and not grab the sometimes I'll grab the breakfast buffet of bacon, sausage, ham, and eggs. And I know it's not bad for us, but some of that is probably not as clean because it's in a petro. It's not grass-fed, you know. So that's one thing. If I could do more, add more refrigeration, I could cook better stuff at home, bring it with me, and warm it. And that would be one right. thing I'm thinking. I do eat an avocado every day. And like I say, I do need to find some way to I love coffee, I love the caffeine, and to be able to stomach the taste. I'm gonna try. You have mentioned some of the other things you do, trying some other things in the bulletproof coffee that will make it where it's palatable to the taste. You know, that's and I try to. You know, I very rarely grab any bread. I mean, that's so rare. I mean, it's extremely rare.
Yeah.
I've lost 50 pounds three times in the last 20 years on Atkins or ketogenic diet, you know, over the years. I mean, I'm right now keeping it right around 210. I came down, I was 237 last year when you saw me at the CMC. I came down pretty quick because we all went ketogenic right after that. You know, everybody's lost some.
Right.
I kind of leveled off here. The wintertime was tough for exercise. I think if I get the exercise up and clean up the eating a little bit, 6 months' time, I may have the HDL to 60, triglycerides down a bit. I really don't care about the LDL if I got the same.
Exactly.
To me is what I'm looking at.
You know what? Keep doing exactly what you're doing because you're to the point where all you need are little tweaks, and you mentioned them all. Some more fermented vegetables, trying to make sure the fats are a little cleaner. Those are all those final tweaks. You're right there, and your numbers are looking good. So keep doing what you're doing. Check in with me. Let me know how it's going. Let's go to Florida. Eddie, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Kevin. I have a question about taxes.
Okay.
Back in 2012, I had an accident, damaged about $8,600 on my trailer. I sued the company, actually, because they agreed to pay the repair, but then they retracted. Anyway, I had to hire a lawyer. It took 3 years to get $12,500 they settled for. Back
okay.
in 2012, I... deduce out of my taxes the repairs of the trailer
right.
for about $8,900 plus some expenses. So total, like I deducted $10,000. Now I receive $11,000. How do I go about?
How do you show that on your tax return?
Right, and what kind of income?
I'm gonna give you a general answer just because sometimes lawsuits can get complicated when it comes to taxes, and the reason they can is because the money can be awarded for different things, and the way the money gets awarded affects how it gets taxed. And without having a document right in front of me that I could verify, I'm just going to give you a general answer. But this is definitely something you want to make sure your tax preparer looks closely at. For example, there are lawsuits that award money for damages. And if it's damages, it's usually not taxable. There are lawsuits that award money for loss of wages. That's clearly taxable because the wages would have been taxable if you had them. In this case, I'm assuming you're recovering the expense that you had. I'm assuming that's what this award was for. And then other times it can be split. Part of the money can be for this and this and this. I've seen awards with three or four different categories of money. It sounds to me like most of this is a reimbursement of your expense. And if that's the case, then it is income. And the reason that it's income is because you deducted the expense, which lowered your taxable income back then so that you didn't pay any tax on money back then. But now you've received that money back. So it should have been taxable income in the first place. So that's kind of the general answer without being able to look at the paperwork. But you're going to want to, again, make sure you run this by your tax preparer and they have the documents.
Great. Yeah, I have an idea of what more or less I have to report it as an income. Great, thanks. Just one more little question. And I've
sure.
been contributing to the IRA row like every 5,000, every year, $5,000. Now I'm
excellent.
Like 66 years old. When do I get that money without any penalties?
How old did you say you were?
66.
Oh, you can start taking it any time. You
and
take
no
a
penalty.
Little bit. You can. No penalties. No. And was this, you said a Roth, right?
Yeah. I didn't get any. I think I did 12 cents every year for every $5,000.
Well, that's excellent.
Bucks.
Yeah, that's excellent.
Yeah,
so
no,
not only
saving,
are there,
you know, it's always taxable.
Okay.
Yeah.
If I decided...
Not only. Well, not only is it are there no penalties, there's no tax at all. You get to take that money out. You get every penny of it. You don't have to pay any tax on it.
Great. How about if I decided to keep it, still keep it, and keep it continuing, pouring to, you know, deposit it every year, as long as I can. Would that be
yep,
okay?
You
or
can...
if
yes, that is okay. I would highly recommend it as long as you're earning, keep contributing. The only time you will have to stop is at age 70 and a half, and you'll also have to start taking money out at 70 and a half, at least a little bit each year. There's a formula to calculate it, but as long as you're earning, I would keep contributing.
Great, very good. Thanks very much, Kevin. I really enjoy your show.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Congratulations on saving. That's such a wonderful thing. Let's go to Ohio. AJ, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how are you?
Good. What's on your mind today?
I got a question. Somebody's selling this. Well, he just got it, and he's trying to sell it. He's a mechanic. A 99 Volvo 780. With a 60 series 14 liter. And they just got a frame done.
Okay. That must be a 12.7 liter, not a 14.
Then it's a 60 series, 12 series then?
It is a, yeah, the 60 series Detroit, which has been around forever since like 1987.
Okay.
From 1987 until about 2003, roughly, maybe two, was only available. Well, I got to take that back. For a long time, it was available in an 11 liter and a 12.7. The 11 liter went away in the late 90s, and then in the early 2000s, they started making the 14 liter. And then once we went to emissions, they dropped the 12.7. They, for a year or two, they built a 12.7 emission engine, but the 14 liter is really the emission. There was some crossover there for a little bit. So if it's a 99, unless, and this is, would be really odd, it's possible, but it's pretty unlikely that somebody pulled the 12.7 out, the original engine, and put a 14 liter in it. But I kind of doubt that. Let me get to a break. We'll come back and we'll talk more about that truck. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get right back to the phone calls. I was talking with, let's go back to Ohio. We were talking about a 99 Volvo. AJ, so it's probably a 12.7. I love this truck. This is one of my favorite combinations, a Volvo truck with a Detroit engine. The Volvos just hold up really well, really quality build and cab. They stay quiet. They ride nice. The interior sometimes on a 99 looks just like new. So this is a pretty hard combination to beat.
Yeah, I mean, I know you like this truck, and I just ran into this truck, and this guy was like, this mechanic is hey, I want to, you know, I just bought it, and if you want it, I can sell it to you. And what would be the good price to buy this truck? Is that a 13 speed? And the interior is fairly decent, but it has one issue. It's got some electrical issue in the dash. There's something. I mean, the guy's saying it comes in and out. I know what he paid for. I know what he's asking, but I'm just.
So the electrical issue, you just be prepared. I mean, electrical issues can be frustrating. So, you know, they're not always easy. Sometimes they take a lot of time. The thing with electrical issues, you usually don't run into a lot of parts cost. It's usually all labor. Sometimes they're simple. Sometimes they can be a nightmare. How many miles are on it?
It's
got
1.8.
And how many since an in-frame?
About 200, some give or take.
Okay. So the thing with the truck like this is whoever paid for the in-frame usually gets screwed because you pay $15,000 or $20,000 for the in-frame, but when a truck has 1.8 million miles on it, it's usually the value on the street, what people are willing to pay for it, is usually less than what you just put into the engine. So
yeah.
With 1.8 million miles, these trucks typically go for about 10 grand.
Okay. I mean, that's what he's asking for. Well, he paid a lot less for it.
Yeah. And I have seen people pick up trucks like this for five. And if you can find those deals, I would be all over them. But I would have no problem paying 10 for one. I mean, it's pretty hard to go wrong. You know, the engine is solid with 200,000 miles.
Yeah, if I just replace the whole cab, would it cost me? I mean, would it be just like a glider, I guess, at that time, maybe?
Oh, no, it'd be a whole lot less than that. I mean, I'm still working on pricing for cab replacement, but it's going to be half of what a glider would cost or maybe even less.
Okay. Yeah, and that's what I'm thinking of, just out of the box. I'm trying to, you know, I mean, I'm going to probably get another truck and...
Yeah, this is hard to go wrong. At 10, you know, here's the thing. I don't even care what he paid for it. That's kind of like worrying about how much money a broker has in a load. I don't care. I just want to make sure I'm getting a good value. And to sit here and try to quibble over a couple $1,000, like, you know, maybe we try to get him down to 8. To me, it's hardly worth it. I mean, at 10, I really can't go wrong. It certainly never hurts to go in and offer him. I mean, walk up with a check in your hand for $8,000 and see if he takes it. That never hurts.
Right.
But if he doesn't, I wouldn't walk away from the deal. I mean, I would, if he held firm on his price and I wanted the truck, I'd be willing to pay 10 for this, no question.
Yeah, because I'm thinking that if I go into the electrical problem and you try to chase that wires down, I mean, you're just looking at a whole...
It depends. Like I say, sometimes they're really simple. I've tracked a couple down myself and got lucky. You know, and I'm not even really good at electrical work. I'm kind of a hack. If I have some time, I'll go in there and start poking around with a multimeter and a tester. And once in a while, I get lucky. And,
well,
the thing is,
he said he replaced the wiring harness.
Okay. Yeah,
but,
it just depends.
He hit the bump and everything went away, and then he had another bump and everything came back up.
Yeah, and believe it or not, sometimes it's something goofy like a ground on a firewall. I mean, really, it can. So I wouldn't rule out the fact that this electrical problem could be fixed. In fact, I'm pretty darn sure it can be. So there's one idea of let's try to get the electrical problem fixed. If we do, we have a cheap truck we can go make money with. Or if you've got the budget and the time, looking into a new cab, you can't really go wrong with that either. I mean, you're going to have a lot of value there once you're done if you've got the budget to do that. So really, you'll be fine either way. Let's go to New York. Dave, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call. Say, I've got a question about beet juice. Now, I've been looking for the beet kvass you speak of, and it's hard for me to come by around Milwaukee. But I found this product that it's called the brand name Pure Juice, made in Austria, and it's 100% beet juice. And on the ingredients, it says organic beet. Organic beetroot juice. Then in parentheses says lacto fermented. What is that?
Okay, so here's the good news. That is beet kvass. They may not call it that, but what you are looking at is beet kvass. So you hear us talking about fermenting vegetables all the time, right?
Yeah, all the time. I got a real hard time consuming them because I don't like the flavor.
Well, right. I will tell you, I've kind of always liked pickled stuff, even traditional pickled stuff. It's that sour kind of. I like that. Some people seem to either love it or they hate it. I love it. What we don't say, and it's just to kind of shorten it. Almost all fermented vegetables are lacto-fermented. And what it means is that when you create the brine, the water and the salt, that the level of salt is what stops bad bacteria from growing. That's why it preserves the food and it won't spoil. And it's the perfect environment for lactobacillus bacteria. So lactobacillus is what takes over, and some other bacteria, but primarily lactobacillus, takes over and converts all the sugars to acids that create the fermentation and the sour kind of taste. So virtually all fermented vegetables are lacto-fermented. We just don't use that word.
Okay, great. Well, now I got a couple of containers of some fermented vegetables, some carrots, and some kimchi. And, man, I just got a hard time eating it. But this beet juice is fantastic. But the thing also has 22 grams of sugar in it. And there's no added sugar according to the label.
Okay.
Is that
so
a lot
might...
for the,
It is. It is.
Yeah,
now, here's the thing. So here's what may be going on. Beets are very high in sugar, incredibly high in sugar. Depending on the fermentation process and how long they let it go, and my guess is they didn't let this go very long, and that's why you like it, because not enough of the sugar has been converted the lactic acid.
Oh, that's great.
Just not good enough.
But
here's the thing. Here's the thing. I think it is good enough. I think this is kind of a baby step in the right direction. With your issues, which I'm aware of, beet juice is excellent for you. It's got all kinds of things in it that are good for what's going on with you right now. It's a little sweet, but you know what? That's not the worst thing in the world. And maybe it will help you move towards some of the heavier fermented vegetables. So there's nothing wrong with taking baby steps, especially when those baby steps have some advantages. You're getting all that good beet nutrition that you need.
Yeah, I get you. I like the pickled stuff too, but the sauerkraut, I could eat the heck out of that stuff, but some of this other stuff is a little too fizzy kind of for me. I got a bottle of kombucha, is that what you call that, in the fridge.
Kombucha.
Kombucha, that's it. Now, that's only got 2 grams of sugar. I was excited to find one that low on sugar, but I have yet to take a sip of it, man, because I know what that tastes like.
No question about that. But you know what? You're on the right track. We don't need to get hung up on all the details. We don't have to be perfect. So drink a little. Maybe find a kombucha that's a little higher in sugar, because I'd rather see you drink one that's a little higher in sugar than just not drink it at all. Same with the beet juice. This one's a little high in sugar. I'd rather see you drink that than not at all, and then work your way towards the more heavily fermented stuff. I've got to get out of here. So many questions, so little time. We'll see you next show. Be safe, be profitable. Do the hard work. All right, everybody, thanks, and we'll see you tomorrow for Destination Health and maybe some general questions as well. Thanks, everyone.